With the inception and traction that blockchain and crypto has gathered, the world is possibly on the verge of the largest evolution since the mainstream of the internet. Given the fluidity and dynamic nature of this technology, business leaders, enthusiasts, and veterans all need to band together to navigate the current and upcoming storms. Participants in Web 3.0 want a trusted resource that gives them pertinent information about projects, tokens, technology, and businesses. We are business people talking the business of crypto. We are Y-Whales.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, Y-Whales, wherever in the world you are today. So today is episode 22 of YWeb 3, Navigating the Frontier Technologies. It is March 21st, 2024. The Federal Reserve is really taking a very cautious stance on interest rates. So we had a pause, nothing going forward there, but you know, seeing a lot of crypto players facing government scrutiny. Meanwhile, a big significant institution seeks to understand the potential of Bitcoin while another doubles down on its crypto investments. Massive purchases in Bitcoin worth billions of dollars. We are also seeing major financial firms venture into tokenized assets. This is a big one that we're really excited to say. I think we got a couple great guests that we're going to kind of work through on this. Fact of tokenized assets is a growing field of which a lot of people are interested in. So we're going to cut through a lot of the FUD of what it is and what it isn't. Regulatory pressure is coming down on ETH. We're absolutely seeing the SEC having some fun yet again. They didn't win on Bitcoin, so now they're going to try one more time on the latest series of ETFs coming through. Again, today is March 21st, 2024. Bitcoin is sitting at about 66,700 after kind of a little flash crash that it did. And the NASDAQ is at about 16,500. We have two amazing guests today. Let me go ahead and start with our first timer with us, McDavid. How are you, sir?
Aloha. Thanks for having me.
Perfect. So a little bit of your background and what you're working on today would be fabulous.
Yeah. So yeah, everyone, I'm McDavid. I'm with Aperture Finance. We're building AI powered intents. If you're not familiar with either of those terms, AI you should be, but intents are like basically a different way of doing transactions in Web3. Currently in Web3, obviously you come in and you sign a transaction and you kind of hope you get the outcome you want. With an intent, you declare the outcome you want. You declare your goal, and like a solver essentially will come and fulfill the order for you. And in addition to that, Aperture, we also have quite a bit of experience building intent-like tools for LPs on Uniswap V3 and other concentrated liquidity DEXs. So very familiar with the Uniswap space. And we've, you know, kind of been around for a while. We've lived quite a few lives over the past, you know, three-ish years in crypto. Aperture is also a very famous project on Terra Classic. So we had a lot of...
You're OGs.
We were OGs. We had a front row seat to everything that happened that went down there 2 years ago. And yeah, I'm happy to be here. Talk through some of the headlines today.
Awesome. Fabulous. Very nice to meet you. Lucia, traveling the world, and thank you again for coming by as always. This is, you're a regular at this point. But just for those that may not know you, a little bit of what you're working on now.
Sure. Thanks for having me again. It's always a pleasure to be here and to continuously test my ability to keep up with the news, thanks to you. I am Lucia, and I run an experimentation lab called Emerge. We focus on supporting organizations that are interested in converging their innovation strategy with their social impact strategy. And so we do a fair bit of work across different sectors, whether that's digital identity or loyalty, the environment and climate change related initiatives, et cetera. And then in my spare time, I'm an advisor to a couple of governments and central banks, and also to a couple of companies that are working on large scale infrastructure for Latin America in particular. Yeah, I guess that's a bit about me. I'm happy to be here and super excited to dig in with you and McDavid.
Fabulous. No, and I'm glad that you got some spare time to help the governments out, because they clearly need it. So, you know, let's dive right into the news. And I think, you know, again, it's while we can say we're crypto, we can say we're our own asset class, the world right now kind of just takes a pause and looks at the interest rates. You know, right now we're still sitting at kind of record highs. You know, we inflation has not been taken care of by the variety of, you know, kind of acts that have Congress have tried to spend their way to fix inflation. So it turns out that I think it was the $2 trillion, you know, anti-inflation act didn't really do very well. And so we've, in the United States, we're now seeing 18%, you know, is what has been occurred over the last, you know, 12 months. And so Powell's just said no. It's affecting the crypto a little bit, but I think in a positive way, because it's giving really not a lot of confidence in the dollar at this point. Any thoughts?
McDavid, as a first timer, do you want to go first?
Macro is not my forte, but I can, as just like a, you know, a layman retail trader, I can opine on how I would view.
Absolutely.
I guess there's a lot of like, within crypto, there's still this, a lot of like my friends and finance who are skeptical in crypto will be like, well, like Bitcoin's up just because, you know, all speculative assets are pumping because of, you know, Fed news about rate cuts happening. And so I kind of, am still like looking forward to that trend steadily. Like the correlation between like just general risk assets pumping alongside crypto, I'm like really looking forward to that diverging more and more over time. Mm-hmm. That would prove out a lot of like what Bitcoin maxis think and other, you know, people in crypto think about how a, you know, a weakening US dollar or a sketchy like traditional financial system can, you know,
well,
get more people into crypto.
Yeah, I mean, you're entirely correct. I mean, the other story that we have is out of Argentina, which has now opened up. I mean, very big, you know, suddenly Bitcoin adoption. And this is exactly why Bitcoin was like, you know, invented. It was specifically for, you know, this weakening US dollar and kind of corrupt, you know, fiat system. But the other story that we have is that out of Argentina, they now are allowed to exchange their pesos for USD, and instead they're choosing to put it in Bitcoin by a factor of, I think, like 10 to 1. So much more popular to put move their money into Bitcoin than USD. Are you seeing that a little bit, Lucia, down where you're at?
Yeah, it's a mix. Generally, Argentina historically has always been very aggressive in supporting a crypto ecosystem. Like their contributions to the Ethereum architecture cannot be ignored. So I think Argentina's always been a little bit ahead of other markets in the region. I think, you know, the Federal Reserve has done what it has been doing persistently for the past while, which is to keep everything unchanged. And I think one of the lessons here is really this idea that we are continuing to not acknowledge how the economy is changing. You know, you're really making very similar decisions, hoping that the market will correct itself in a wildly different environment than what historically has happened when the market could actually correct itself. And so I really do believe that, you know, just continuing to do the same thing and hoping that the market will correct itself is a mistake that might lead to, you know, a few bubbles. It might lead to growing inequality, because obviously as things, you know, continue to stay the same, who really feels it is the population that's in the middle class, lower class end of the strict, where, you know, inflation continues to go up and nothing else changes. And we're hoping that, you know, ongoing recovery will somehow magically work for everybody. And so I think, you know, it's really important to have a look at what's going on. And the fact that we continue to say, well, the market will correct itself, but the economy looks nothing today like it did before. We're starting to see so many different trends in different directions that tell us that show us that people are working in different ways, they're consuming in different ways, and that they're choosing to invest in different types of assets. And all of these decisions are sort of really concerning when you have a, you know, key and critical institution like the Federal Reserve choosing actively to continue to hope and pray that the market will self-correct.
Hope is not something you want out of your financial advisors.
What are you saying they should do?
What is your
advice for Jerome Powell?
Oh man, no, don't put me, like, I get put in the hot seat a lot here. I wouldn't pretend that I'm smart enough to tell them what to do, but I would argue that they're being very, very cautious. And I think there's a couple of different economic trends that they need to be factoring in and or assess whether they've been factoring them in before deciding to keep things the same. So I think it's more that. I think there's missing information or there's lack of context in how the economy is different now and how perhaps some of the considerations that they've used historically in hoping that the market would self-correct, and sometimes obviously it did, that those are different, that the landscape is different today. So I think it's really a question of, I don't know the entirety of how they make this decision, but I would argue or advocate that they sort of revisit what those considerations are and assess whether some of the newer landscapes are being factored, changes to the landscape are being factored in. I think that would be my advice to not be a jerk about it.
Well, and you're welcome to be a jerk anytime. Generally to me is preferable.
I'm trying to get multiple advisory jobs.
No, that's why it's like, you can just let me, nobody likes me anyway. And the Ethereum Foundation emails me constantly. But you know, the concept I want to throw out here for our next story is the world has changed. And if we look at, you know, the world pre-Web 1, so, you know, kind of that mid-90s, you know, to about 2002, to 2003, where it was like internet went from like this thing that everyone was playing with to it became like a mainstay of every household and of every business, of every person's life. And then you kind of get into Web 3, where suddenly it's just prolific. It's everywhere. It's not, you don't have to go home to get on the internet. The internet is in anything and everything you do. In fact, we have, you know, Starship, you know, coming through the Earth's atmosphere, live streaming in 4K. Like, it's just, the internet is part of our lives. But the reality is that the infrastructure for the financial system hasn't really changed much since the 60s and 70s. A majority of SWIFT and the exchanges that we use, you know, to move trillions of dollars a day are still on very antiquated systems. And some are even still utilizing dial-up modems, as scary as that is in various parts of the world. So the next part of the story is, I think that you always want to follow, like, who are the smartest, biggest fish in the pond, and what are they looking at? What are they doing? And Lucia, this is a story that you and I have talked about at length. I have a startup in the space of tokenized assets. McDavid, you guys are, you know, everything you're doing is leading towards, you know, not just crypto and you know, meme coins and you know, server tokens or whatever you want to call, you know, a lot of these various crypto things we talk about, but starting to move, you know, securities, commodities, and assets into a blockchain-based system. And so the story right now is that BlackRock, who we all know, is made a big bet. They've acquired, I think, a little over, 200,000 Bitcoin into their ETF fund in less than 60 days. So they went from, like, Bitcoin bad to, like, you know, come, let us hold your Bitcoin. And now we're seeing BlackRock is working with Securitize. I love Carlos. I think he's absolutely great on it. I would say this is a relatively small fund. So it's about $100 million. So it's very clearly a test at this point, but it's still news that you now have some of the largest asset holders on the planet understanding that these centralized databases that they have are no longer adequate to move at the speed of finance of where it's going today. Lucy, I'll jump right over to you because, you know, this is what you're working on. There's governments that want to understand this. Tokenization is a very broad word. And so I want to, you know, if you wouldn't mind, my definition is different than yours. It's probably different than McDavid's, but I'd love you just kind of define what you think of tokenization in this capacity.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I've been laughing at this with some criticism regarding the lack of creativity on the name. I think that's hilarious. It is a small fund. I also agree with you. I think Carlos is great. I think they went with a really great choice in partnering with Securitize. I mean, in relation to this idea of like tokenizing everything, you're essentially turning an asset into something that has digital rights that you can then put up for sale, trade, et cetera, right? So you're just enabling something to have this representation of value that can now be issued as a digital token and that enables a more allegedly effective or efficient trade or ability to buy and sell. So I think there's obviously a lot of benefits to doing this. That might be, you know, it enables fractionalized ownership of assets. So you can enable more people to buy into a particular asset. You can improve, allegedly, the transparency around it and the auditability around it. You can reduce the transaction costs from buying and selling, and you can increase the liquidity that's available for a particular asset. So there's got a lot of benefits. There's also this idea that because it is now within a digital realm, that you could remove certain geographic limitations and, you know, requirements around participation, which in essence, would be able to democratize access to some of these markets, which historically have been banned for one reason or other for certain types of investors. And so ultimately, there's a lot of opportunities here. I think governments are interested in some parts of the world. Getting ahead of myself and what we're going to talk about in this episode, I think it's very interesting that we hear that BlackRock, which obviously is legendary in the space, is, you know, launching something within the Ethereum blockchain. And then now the SEC is investigating the Ethereum blockchain, which, or the Ethereum Foundation. But I think, you know, that goes to show the receptiveness that some governments have and the possibilities around having discussions that entail regulating this, putting people together to try to figure out how to tokenize, where the government plays a role in this, you know, being proactive about enabling some of these innovations, because clearly that's where the private markets are going. And, you know, you're starting to see so much interest. You see ETFs in different parts of the world. You see different types of funds that are, you know, now becoming available in different parts of the world. And so I think it's giving you, this story particularly, is giving you a really good insight into how governments will react to this. There's going to be some governments, like the ones I work with, let's say the government of Cayman, who puts together a round table to try to understand where the government of Cayman can fit in and how they can provide competitive regulatory clarity for people that want to come on island and innovate. And then you've got this, you know, counterpart where the SEC is now launching an investigation into what is, you know, something that's been reputable for a really long time and also something that's been around for a really long time. And the timing of that is really interesting. And so,
A couple things on that I just want to hit real quick, and then McDavid, you're up. But the number one, we're going to talk about the Ethereum Foundation and the SEC later, but like it's starting to become a rhythm in this, that it's like BlackRock gets interested in something, you know, before the ETFs were approved, we got to get rid of CZ. And now suddenly magically they're approved. And now it's like, hey, we want to do this Ethereum thing. SEC is like, well, we got to go attack. You got to go deal with these people before it's there. So it really is interesting that they kind of their diligence really gets into individuals in some cases.
And well, so also the narratives around, yeah, this, right, where it's not like, hey, let us figure out how we can do this and like be proactive and responsible about it. It's like, hey, something's going on in this space. Let me investigate it and see if there's something wrong with it. And that narrative, like that negativity within how this dynamic takes place, I think is really impacting the attitudinal, you know, creative process of innovation within the US. And so when you hear a government come and say like, hey, we hear that, you know, we're trying to tokenize everything, let's figure out how we can provide regulatory clarity for that versus a narrative that says, oh, we're going to investigate whatever players are involved in this deal, I think it's a very different dynamic. And I think it goes to show exactly the two extremes of, you know, decisions that governments can make in order to ensure that innovation is taking place responsibly, but also that there's competitiveness within that jurisdiction.
There we go. Let's go.
You can't really compare the Cayman Islands to the United States. Like, they're two very different financial systems. They have very different, like, the US is coming from the position of being the, you know, global financial leader versus the Cayman Islands, which is a very like scrappy entrepreneurial government that's trying, they're going to do everything to foster innovation. They're going to, you know, allow any rule to be bent in a way if it can like attract dollars or crypto to come on shore. So I feel like that those can't be compared. I'm actually more sympathetic to how things are playing out in the US regulatory system. And I think a lot of it is like to be expected. And it does not mean that people don't like the entire industry, and a lot of people who aren't even in crypto can't see that how this is eventually going to play out, which is that the US government will drag their feet and there'll be lots of attempts to regulate. But I'm pretty confident that at the end of the day, markets always win, and people in the US want crypto, and voters in the US are going to want crypto. And eventually we're going to have a system that's more open to crypto, but there will be, of course, like the SEC is going to, you know, go down kicking and screaming.
I mean, Americans also want TikTok, and that didn't really stop anyone from trying to ban that, right? So, I mean, it's not about comparing.
Well, TikTok's not getting banned.
What?
It's getting sold.
It's getting sold.
Yeah. I mean, it's a for sale that will involve a fair bit of censorship if it goes through, right? But inherently, that
just censorship.
What?
It's not going to be censored if it gets sold.
You don't think that selling to vested interested parties will inevitably lead to greater censorship within the application?
No. Okay. The fear right now is that the application would be censored by having like this dubious overhang within mainland China. But if you sell it to any party that it gets sold to, they're going to optimize it for making money, whatever that looks like, as ByteDance is going to do. But ByteDance potentially has the added weirdness of like the Communist Party being in their ear in their main office in Beijing.
I mean, content, I don't know how much time you spend on TikTok, but content wise, you know, there are people out there testing the degree of banning by talking about different subjects. And, you know, there's less censorship on Chinese issues than there is censorship on other issues. So it's a really interesting, I personally think there will be, if they're forced to sell, depending on who acquires the rights to this company in the US, I think there will inevitably be greater censorship to particular issues that the US government is sensitive to. But I'm not trying to compare the government of Cayman Islands to the government of the US. I'm trying to compare the attitudes of regulators in both places. And I think that that is a fair thing to be.
I'll jump in and back up a little bit this, you know, because I always go back to history, you know, and the just as we talked about Web 1, you know, when e-commerce was like the big buzzword, you know, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, the U.S. government was absolutely like, no, we need this new technology to foster. We need it to grow. And they actually said, don't worry about sales tax. Don't worry about sales tax. Don't worry about cross payments. Just go ahead and do whatever you want. And they really allowed Amazon and a bunch of others to undercut brick and mortar retailers. I was one of them that dealt with that at the time. And so this kind of attitude that we have right now about, like, let me be clear. I saw somebody say Solana ETF coming soon, and I can literally hear the Solana Foundation say, no, don't leave us alone. You know, but it's regulating through through legal manners is just not a great way to do it. And we've seen this time and time again. It's like, hey, we want to give more clarity to Coinbase, so let's sue them and then we'll decide it there. Let's, you know, Kraken, hey, we want to understand you want to do a staking thing. We're going to sue you. And if you win, then you can do it. I really don't think that that's a very innovative approach, because the rest of the world, and we've got, you know, the biggest thing we've got coming down the road right now is MiCA out of the EU in June. And that is 100%, I will tell you, from as being an American, there is no developers right now looking at launching protocols in the United States that aren't looking at MiCA saying, tokenization of real world assets, very clear, very concise. Here's how you manage it, and no one's going to go to jail for it as long as you play by the rules. And the regulators are welcoming, you know, dozens and dozens of companies. In fact, it's become in Switzerland, Zug, Zurich, and a variety of others, Germany as well. I mean, it is like there are companies literally relocating all last year and this year in preparation for it. Versus, there's a lot of innovation in the United States. But to circle back around to, you know, kind of the ETF or the ETF ETH issue right now, I mean, it is very clear. We haven't heard, I don't think anything clear from Vitalik at this point. You know, he gave a couple tweets and whatnot. But, you know, I don't know if there's a canary in the coal mine per se with the ETH Foundation. I would think that it's been decentralized long enough. It's been out there long enough. They've investigated a dozen times. So I'm not entirely sure from that capacity. But, you know, when we get into the concept of tokenized assets, we do, and which where we started this, now we're circling back around, that, you know, I really do believe this is the future of finance, that, you know, the, you know, thousand trillion plus dollars, so it'd be a quadrillion plus dollars, whatever it is, some insane amount of money, is going to leave these centralized servers that they've been, you know, kind of building on since the 60s and 70s and start migrating their way into, you know, true democratized securities on the blockchain. Securitize is one, DigiShares, Polymesh. Like I said, we're launching FinRamp. So we know it's a growing category that every country is going to want to have their regulations in place because it speeds up commerce by, you know, factors of 100, if not more. So, you know, McDavid, to me, this is like right up your guys' alley. You know, it's like, I would like to invest in this and without having to worry about, you know, what is the New York Stock Exchange offering? What is, you know, what is the Cayman Stock Exchange offering? You suddenly have a global approach saying, I want to invest in real estate that earns me X amount of yield. And you may be able to suddenly do it in the UK and in Singapore and a variety of places to say, what is that, you know, actionable item and what can I see out there from tokenized assets? Is that kind of anything you guys have thought through so far?
Yeah. Before I get into that, I was actually a little bit curious to understand more about like what we think BlackRock is actually going to do with this 100 million USDC that's now sitting on chain. Because it seems like it's kind of vague at the moment. They haven't really disclosed the exact plan. Do you have like a speculation as to what?
Yeah, I mean, Securitize does like, you know, a couple things, and that's what they do well. So, you know, they're going to do most likely corporate equity, offerings, no assets, I would say, at this point right now. So they're kind of doing, you can go on Securitize website. I guarantee you they've got everything else out there. But it most likely it's going to be, you know, a lot more along the lines of, you know, corporate shares type stuff. Before we start on our next topic, here's something really exciting. Everyone struggles with these really highly complex, you know, intricate Ethereum names. ENS has a solution that's really game-changing for you. Revolutionizing your digital identity with ENS. Transform long, complex Ethereum name addresses into easy-to-remember names, safely, securely, and uniquely yours. Visit ens.app to get started today, and ENS welcomes you to the new internet.
Okay, and then like you just have to KYC through Securitize to purchase this, or is it just going to be like bank-to-bank settling on this?
They haven't actually published. I personally think they went with the announcement pretty early. To my understanding, there isn't much clarity around the specifics or details of it quite yet. But historically, I think Securitize has handled KYC AML, and I think they focus specifically for now, at least, on like corporate equity and things like that. So I would assume that they would continue to do what Securitize has been doing for the past 2 years, and then hopefully open up a couple more down the line, opportunities down the line. But I don't think
How do you trade? Like, how do you determine the price to pay for something? Does that happen offline and then they just like settle on this chain, or like what is the?
Yeah. So generally, you know, Securitize has a couple of different ways they do things. Most likely this is going to be kind of a, you know, walled garden, per se, trial test, which is majority of what we're seeing tokenized assets do. JP Morgan has Onyx, and they're just doing, you know, kind of bank to bank transfers right now on it. So I wouldn't imagine, you know, that phase one of this is going to be, you know, hey, they're just going to load these tokens over on Uni and say, have at it. They're going to be KYC, they're going to be AML, they're going to be OFAC compliance. So it's going to be, you know, whatever brokerages are allowed, or you'll be able to buy them from BlackRock. They just most likely, I think will be a little bit of time to see, but the fact is that they're running tests. We saw the CDBC tests, go on, with a variety of the big guys. We're now seeing the tokenization tests. This is most likely, corporate equity, corporate debt type products, which is generally what they do. But then, you know, again, we have Red Swan. We've got a lot of these guys that we know in our network that are doing commercial real estate and a variety of others. And it's just a matter of time before you hit that breaking point of going, why would I invest in the meme coins when I get legal yield? Legal yield from my investments. So first of the month, you know, I'm getting a distribution back on my commercial real estate holdings. You know, hey, this investment did a distribution and it just shows up on my wallet, taxes paid, everything else. And so we're seeing the iterations of that, but I think we're still a few years away. And I think that's $100 million for BlackRock is like their catering budget for an event.
I guess I'm curious because like, I wonder how they will eventually like handle asset swapping on chain and how they will like determine the prices of assets. I'm like kind of curious, like what direction all of that's headed in. Cause it seems to me like right now they're probably, everything's being like, the price is being determined off chain and it's like just settling on one of these like walled gardens.
Most likely you're probably 100% correct on that. And we'll circle back around, but I think the biggest point is like, it's coming. You know, we've heard for a long time, real world assets, this and that. But it does take the big guys to do it because there's a lot of securities laws in place, and I'm excited to see how they kind of manage these.
I was flipping through their website to try to see anything more on the announcement, but they just haven't released much information on it.
Yeah, it's probably going to be what they do currently today. Yeah. But now, you know, there's a BlackRock, version of it that they're doing.
So. I think the announcement's early, to be honest. I think they launched it a bit early, and that obviously tends to happen in our space, but, you know.
Or the whole thing is a nothing burger.
I know Carlos enough
yeah,
to know he's a very smart guy and he's very determined. He will get it done.
Yeah.
I think it's to me, this is, they didn't say it an exploratory fund, but it seems kind of one of those things. If this was like BlackRock going all in on tokenization, you'd see them, you know, it'd be billions of dollars of assets being moved on there. So I think this is them getting comfortable with Carlos and his team and understanding what the possibilities of it are. So interesting pilot per se. Jumping forward, again, we got to go back to the big stories, which is Bitcoin, and really leading, you know, I mean, listen, Lucia, I think the last time you and I talked, Bitcoin, was maybe at 35. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's definitely had a nice little run. I keep hearing people say the bull run. We're seeing the meme coins go through. But the biggest thing here now is to see, not just institutions, but governments starting to stack. And that's what you want. I mean, we want to see, acquisitions of long-term holdings to reduce the liquidity of Bitcoin, you know, as much depending on what your thesis is, to kind of bring that price up. So the way you get to $250,000 or $500,000 Bitcoin is through scarcity, supply and demand. So a couple stories today. Number one is Japan's largest pension fund is purchasing Bitcoin. So they are now filed and they're authorized to start purchasing. They hold about $1.4 trillion in assets. That's about the same size as Scotiabank globally. So these are large institutions with lots of buying power. And even if they only put 1%, but lately I've been seeing people talk about 3% is what they're putting in Bitcoin, which is, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, this is what we've come to expect out of several international markets at this point. Like it you'd be very hard pressed to find a couple of, you know, institutional investors that are just going to say downright they're not open to at least considering or studying the potential for Bitcoin within their portfolio. I think this is really interesting geographical implications because it's obviously you know, dominant pension fund in a country that is quite forward thinking about, you know, about building their economy and innovation. So I think it'll have some interesting inspiration for a couple of other international economies to start looking at, you know, how they can potentially incorporate Bitcoin into their, like, it's different for Japan to say it than it is for, let's say, El Salvador to say it, though, obviously, you know, we've started to see a few countries. Brazil obviously has been leading the charge and also making, you know, government decisions that relate to supporting Bitcoin. So I think, and then Argentina, of course. So I think it's an interesting, you know, and now it's one of those announcements that, again, it's like, well, they're looking for information. You know, we've seen a lot of this before where it's like they announce this, they look forward thinking that, you know, they're not writing anything off. They study the effects of this announcement and then make a decision. I've been through this several times with a couple of central banks where they invite me, they study it, they put out a press release, they say they're looking into it, and then I don't hear from them until a year later where they do the exact same thing. So, you know, I'm curious to see where this will go, but I think we've reached a point where I think, you know, it's hard to ignore that it might be healthy as a diversification strategy to at least consider having some Bitcoin in a portfolio. And I'm really excited about, you know, whether they go forward with this or not.
Well, and I think, you know, McDavid, you probably saw the announcement that, you know, every bank was like, absolutely, Bitcoin ETFs. And the Vanguard CEO was like, absolutely not. No way. We're not going to allow any of our clients access to Bitcoin. And literally like 3 weeks after the ETFs launched, like he's removed. Mm-hmm. He's just gone. You know, is your feeling at this point now, it's kind of like Bitcoin is just a global asset that we all need to accommodate?
Yeah, I mean, Bitcoin at this point feels like a almost like it's getting close to being just like a boomer asset. Like it's a very, I think the general population does not view Bitcoin as being that risky anymore. It just feels like another volatile commodity to a lot of people. And I think this is all very expected. I would expect all major like institutional capital managers to start incorporating some Bitcoin exposure into their portfolios over the next like 5 to 10 years. That'll just be table stakes and not even, it won't even be a news story, hopefully, in 1 to 2 years time from now.
I think a big piece of that depends where you are in like the, what market you're in and also like where you are on the wealth spectrum. I think that for a lot of people that have, you know, some kind of financial advisor, some kind of, you know, diversity in their financial assets, I think absolutely you're right that they're starting to really become comfortable with this idea of Bitcoin. I think for, you know, people that are starting to save out, it's either or. Like if you're on the younger side, then probably you're very receptive to this. But if you are like good old fashioned, you know, family of four in the middle of the US or in a country that has not really made a lot of noise about this kind of thing, I think there's still some fear factor and hesitation. And I think a couple of episodes back, one of the headlines was around European sentiment in crypto and how essentially even rolling out ETFs within Europe had not changed a lot of the attitudinal concerns that a lot of just normal middle-class Europeans had toward cryptocurrency. So I think it's really interesting to sort of study the different ways in which geography impacts how people feel about this. And I think that in the US, you're right, I think people are becoming quite comfortable with having some Bitcoin exposure. And there are other markets that are quite advanced in that, even more so than the US. But I still think that, you know, there's a couple of big regions where this is still, there's still fear factor concerned with cryptocurrencies. Europe, interestingly, being one of them, despite having the most amount of regulatory clarity at the moment.
Absolutely. Well, one person who has no fear of Bitcoin or risk is Mr. Saylor, who has just purchased another 9,000 Bitcoin, 9,245 Bitcoin, of which he took another loan. So this is the second. He said, I want to raise $600 million, you know, for senior convertible notes. He ended up raising $800 million, turned around, bought, you know, I think 12,000 Bitcoin. And then literally as soon as he closed on that, he raised another, he said, I'll do another 500. He raised over 600 million on that. And these are like at like a 0.5% interest rate over like a, what, 5-6 year period. So I don't even,
how does he get 0.5% interest rate?
He just literally, cause there's senior notes that he's doing this. And so he now has, you know, what I think his goal was, which is 1% of the total Bitcoin allocation. So there's 21 million Bitcoin that will ever be made. He's got 214,000, so he's got a little over that 1%. And you know, his average purchase price is $67,000. So as of today, you know, he's underwater. You know, it's at, because we're at 66. So you know, he's purchased.
Well, that was for the new. That was for the latest purchase.
The average. You're right. That's the latest purchase. Yeah. What's his average? I don't think I have that here. So yeah. So he purchased at 67,000. I forget what his average is. But yeah, his total Bitcoin holdings a little bit over 7.5 billion today. And I really wonder, what does this even do to MicroStrategy? Like at what point is it even, he's not a zombie stock per se, because they have an active business. But it's nothing compared now to this holdings that they have of like almost, you know, I don't even know what they are. They're a custodian for Bitcoin.
I wish he would stop. That's kind of my general sentiment.
Like, he's got enough Bitcoin. He just needs to move on with his life.
Yeah. There comes a point where like, I really, you know, the inner activist in me that is saying like, man, I really want more people to gain access to Bitcoin. I really, obviously, like it does so much in terms of validation. Though I think, you know, right now, a lot of normal people that are not within the crypto industry kind of see him as someone that's like, you know, a Bitcoin maxi that you don't necessarily follow, but more that he just like exists. Yes, he like really believes in it. And it went from being a, wow, MicroStrategy really believes in this to a, Yeah, he believes in this. Like, we know that. And it's like, I don't know how, you know, the people that I've asked around that are not specifically within the industry no longer view him as like the validator that he was when he first started this on this mission. Obviously, within the industry, it's a different sentiment. You can hate him or love him for how much he's accumulating. I personally would love to say he has enough and for him to stop buying. But I mean, it's one of those things like, what is El Salvador doing, right? Like, they need liquidity because they are a national government that constantly trades, and yet they continue also to purchase and recently made a purchase. And so I think a big piece of it is like they're essentially making a statement on what is valuable to hold and what their predictions are for what is no longer viable or valuable to hold in the long term. And I think that's a big statement. You know, from El Salvador, we know he's making a statement on the US dollar. From MicroStrategy, I think it's more a statement pro Bitcoin than it is anti anything. But that's really what it is to me. It's one of those things of like, what holds value? We are backing this as the valuable thing to provide us greater liquidity in the future. But I personally wish he would stop buying. I think we've gotten to that point for me.
there's some board that I'm sure he still has control over that's like, dude, like, you know, what are you going to keep doing here?
He's come under fire before when the market was very, very, very down. Like when we were
he was close to insolvent.
Of course. And so, you know, it comes out there. That picture is really freaking me out and hilarious at the same time. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, like you don't mess with something that's going well. You mess with it when it's not going well. And right now, obviously, you know, maybe his most recent purchase isn't profitable yet, but on the whole, you could really say that he's made a bet that's mostly paid off for them, you know? Yeah. And so,
I would say, I wonder now that there's like very easy to buy like Bitcoin spot ETFs, like how their stock compares to these ETFs in terms of performance and like how closely it tracks the price of Bitcoin. Cause I do wonder at some point, like I kind of viewed this as he is just for the sake of the company's value. He's like, well, I'm just going to go super long on Bitcoin. There's not really any real innovation to be had beyond me being just kind of like weird proxy for the Bitcoin price. But I'm curious now how this like plays out with like Bitcoin being so easy to buy. On Fidelity
I honestly tried to use ChatGPT to run the numbers to say like, okay, if Bitcoin hits 200,000, what is MicroStrategy's price per share? And it was like, there's too many dynamical things because it's not an ETF. It's not an investment vehicle. It's a company that one of the random assets on their books just happens to be this massive stack of Bitcoin. So it's very hard to understand, you know, what they're doing.
This is one of those things, though, that because we don't know what's going on internally, like there might very well be a couple of conditions around those holdings, right? Like if there's a certain price or if there's a certain loss in the traditional core competency of MicroStrategy that perhaps, you know, some of the Bitcoin holdings are supposed to supplant that, or like at the moment, we're assuming that he's buying and holding with no conditions, but it might be a very interesting internal mechanism. And if I were a company that is at that scale, that is acquiring that kind of Bitcoin, then I would probably want these kinds of conditions in place where I say, like, you know, if MicroStrategy's business hits X amount of loss or X amount of risk, then essentially my Bitcoin treasury supplants that in some sort of way. And then once we recover, then it goes back into treasury or something like that. Like I would play around with, you know, what is the value of holding this asset and how does it juxtapose against the rest of my income or revenue as a company? And then how do I sort of use this increase in pricing and my overall good decision in acquiring it over time to offset some of the risks or new innovation or new R&D or whatever that I'm doing elsewhere? And I think having those things in internal mechanisms in place might be a reason why you're sort of seeing, you know, internal support for this strategy. It might not be just a simple buy hold. It might be something that, you know, is actually feeding the company from within. And I think if that were the case, I would be fascinated to see what those mechanisms would be. And I think it would make for some really, really compelling and like visionary leadership on the part of MicroStrategy.
I fully agree. Jumping back a little bit back over to the ETH ETFs the applications have been in. We saw the SEC wait till the very last possible second. Like they pushed off every single kind of delay that they could to finally approve all these Bitcoin ETFs. The ETH ones were really not very interesting to me because unstaked ETH, sure, you can have that viability, but if you can't stake it, there's some issues there. I wasn't concerned because my other concern is if you suddenly have BlackRock accumulating these massive, you know, piles of Ethereum, you know, then and stake it, then they have a lot of voting power on the network, and that's a little bit scary. But I wasn't concerned at first because all the it was a cash creates protocol with these ETFs, and so you couldn't stake them inside the ETFs. So it's like, okay, they're just going to be holding a bunch of coins that are off market. It will increase everyone's gas prices, but you know, like it just wasn't very interesting to me. Grayscale and Fidelity just now amended theirs to say that they do want to be able to stake. which means that you do not have custodians that are making, you know, votes on what's occurring on the network, and that's a little worrisome.
Well, do we know that for sure? Is it possible they would give it to another validator? Like, do we assume they're going to get in the business of like running their own validators?
I would not assume anything good from these guys having that level of control at this time. There's never been a time that Grayscale, I think you could theoretically trust, but let's not throw them too far. You start getting into Fidelity and the normal TradFi guys. Let's be clear of who's in control of those. The CEOs are going to be like, absolutely, we want to maximize profits. You know, we have shareholders that need to do these things. So I think it really, that gets a little bit scary, that these were all designed to be anti, you know, Wall Street and big money. And now this is who technically, I mean, already Amazon has majority of the node control of Ethereum to begin with. Now they have actual true voting power is my concern.
Yeah, yes. Go ahead.
My armchair speculation would be that Fidelity or any of these other TradFi giants that are getting into giving Ethereum staking yield to their customers would not want to be in the business of validating the chain itself. They would delegate that to a third party, such as Lido or possibly Coinbase or some other institution, because I don't think they would want to have to deal with the like regulatory headache of like approving transactions that are coming from parties that they can't fully verify, and like what that would expose them to potentially under like anti-money laundering laws or other like legal issues that they could fall under. So my speculation is that they would just gladly hand this over to Lido or Coinbase or some other institution. But that's,
yeah, we will absolutely see what they're doing. Like I said, there's not a lot of details now. They're just amending these ETFs. Obviously, no ETF has been done, but we're seeing them all kind of in unison do the same thing. We saw the same thing happen with Bitcoin. It went from, you know, a lot of them early on were saying that they wanted to use OTC to be able to acquire Bitcoin for the ETFs. And then the SEC came out with the cash creates, which means they had to be buying and selling in the open market. They couldn't be doing any backroom deals with any dark Bitcoin. It all had to be bought in the market at market pricing, which is huge. That's the reason why we're seeing Bitcoin go up, is because it's transparent what these ETFs are doing versus just every day they just tell you, yeah, we got 100,000 more, but we're not going to tell you what we paid for.
I'd be really curious to see the risk assessment for the BlackRock Securitize decision on the basis of like these, should this be approved? Because it also, like, they're amending the application, but that doesn't necessarily mean that A, that application will get approved, or B, that even if it does get approved, that it'll get approved in this way. Like, they might be required to make some changes for approvals that we just don't know, you know, are going to happen. And so, but it would be interesting to see the risk assessment in BlackRock and Securitize sort of saying, hey, you know, we're going to choose Ethereum, but then seeing that, you know, the market might be influenced by this idea that these kind, you know, Grayscale and Fidelity could become network validators, could be heavily involved in governance, et cetera, and what that sort of influences across the different types of, you know, major funds and you know, organizations that are trying to now become competitive on Ethereum as well.
Today's episode is proudly sponsored by Beyond Enterprises, the ultimate 360-degree partner for companies ready to embrace the power of blockchain in their business strategies. Beyond Enterprises stands out as a beacon of expertise with a blockchain agnostic approach that has seen successful projects on Ethereum, EOS, and Arc. Guided by blockchain thought leaders and fueled by inspired advisors, the team has played a pivotal role in over 40 successful ventures spanning token generation events, security token offerings, exchanges, and more. From healthcare to travel, finance, and beyond, Beyond Enterprises has left a massive mark on diverse industries. Elevate your business strategy today with pioneers of blockchain integrations, Beyond Enterprises, trusted 360 partner. Yeah. No, I mean, it's a rapidly evolving world. And now that TradFi wants to play in the blockchain world, which is great, because that's where all the money, the big money comes from. We just want to make sure we don't lose the values of which, you know, we really started this initiative, which was like, hey, transparency, openness, fairness, and a variety of other things that we all want to see happen. Over into kind of, you know, new chains. So Coinbase, which this is a private network base. I have not spent any time whatsoever on there. It is a layer 2 off of Ethereum. McDavid, do you guys support base yet, or have you What's your thoughts on Base? I haven't done any work on it.
Yeah, we do support Base. Yeah, I guess the story on Base was there was kind of like an initial surge in usage. So like in general, the total pie of users in DeFi is not massively growing, but there is a very active core group of users. But what this means is that these users are very opportunistic, and they will often rotate from chain to chain based on whatever speculative fad is the, you know, soup du jour of the moment. And Base initially had a lot of activity the last summer when it first launched. There was quite a bit of like marketing around it, but also there were a few applications and one meme coin at the time, Bald, which was kind of a joke about Brian Armstrong being bald or other various men in crypto being bald. And then there was a big app called Frentech, which has now since fallen by the wayside, but it drove a lot of activity. It was initially only on Base before there were a million copycats on other chains. And then that kind of simmered down and users sort of started rotating into other chains over the last like 6 months. You know, Blast saw a lot of activity. There was Manta, which is a new L2 that got a lot of activity, as long as, you know, there's also a bunch of other L2s that people were spending time on. But now I guess it looks like maybe because of the upgrade and gas prices coming down, I'm speculating that Base is starting to see some like meme coin activity. Solana is
crushing it.
Kind of still the gold standard for where to launch and trade a meme coin because of the user experience of that chain. But I guess with the Dunkoon upgrade, it's possible that the gas costs for these layer twos is going to be cheap enough that maybe we'll start to see the same kind of meme coin velocity that we have on Solana, where there's like meme coins being made every hour and the throughput of them is kind of insane.
I was just on Twitter this morning and I follow a bunch of security experts. This guy goes, you know, he found a scammer on Base that would launch a new token with 0.8 ETH. And as soon as it got up to one ETH, he would rug it. And he goes, I've watched now happen a dozen times and I got really mad until he realized, he goes, literally, I got mad until I realized that all he was doing was scamming these token launching bots that just buy any new coin that exists. And so like he's making 0.2 ETH at a time.
Good ass to that guy. That's DeFi.
Rugging the bots. And I go, that is just the most degen thing. It's perfect. I love it.
It's the tiniest amount of profit. It's like a 25% gain, which is like, you know, comically.
You quit enough times and like, it's a pretty easy way to make a paycheck per day. Like, that's crazy.
I mean, it's for an automated thing. And they literally said it's the same picture, bunch of random garbage words. Right. And, you know, people have trained to like any new coin that comes on, just go ahead and, you know, buy up so much. And he's just been doing this over and over for the last few days. But I think it really does showcase that, like, number one, gas prices are a factor of adoption. And, you know, we've seen there's so many level ones, there's so many level twos, and we're now into level threes and roll-ups and everything else. But at the end of the day, like, it is really hard to say it's, you know, on running on raw Ethereum, which is where BlackRock is. I mean, it's expensive, it is slow, it is cumbersome. Launching a smart contract, we've launched smart contracts at you know, when it was, you know, $50,000, $60,000 Bitcoin, and I'm sorry, like, you know, $3,000-$4,000 ETH. And I mean, in some cases, we're spending $20,000-$30,000 to deploy smart contracts. So it's very expensive to run on an L1. And then you've got Base and Solana. And like I said, it's just like, you can play, you can do this stuff. And so if you're, you know, whether it's meme coins or whether you're just doing an app that has like membership rewards, it works. It's great. You know, no big deal. Enjoy it. So I love seeing this. I don't know the long-term staying power for Base, and I don't think the SEC has really come down on them yet for like, what are you doing and what is all this stuff? So I've always said, what's their liability? Yeah. You know, we'll see, which I think is your same thought as mine.
Yeah. But also, you know, it's interesting because in fact, you know, it is a determinant in saying, I don't want to pay a lot in fees. Makes no sense. But then at the same time, you wouldn't launch a corporate, you know, loyalty or membership or whatever program on something like a Solana because of the negative association with, like, you know, meme coins, scams, like the branding around that isn't that great, right? So even if you pay more fees on something like a Polygon, you would go for a Polygon over Solana. You would not touch Ethereum, right? So there's a couple of considerations in at least, like, let's say, you know, where it where brand matters, where like the ecosystem itself also matters, like this idea that, you know, you might be a government or a company or some kind of organization where you can't just go and launch in like the most degen of ecosystems because you're going to get a lot of pushback for that, right? And so even like UNICEF, for example, a couple of years ago tried to deploy an NFT project. And at the time, you know, the environmental footprint of NFTs were all the rage, and they had to walk that project back because they launched within a community and an ecosystem and a feature of blockchain that just it didn't have the correct conditions for them, right? So I do agree with you that for like the traditional investor, the fees that they're going to pay do matter a lot. But I think for brands, governments, organizations, et cetera, there's like this added element of, can I feasibly use this blockchain without the negative connotations that come from it? Because I have to get this passed through a bunch of decision makers that might have some skepticism in relation to blockchain already.
100%. 100%. Real quick, as we kind of run through the last few stories here as we're getting close to the top of the hour. AI tokens, which to my knowledge, most have nothing to do with AI. It's just a very nicely named token, and some of them may do something related to AI at some point, are going up a little bit. But, you know, to me, again, this kind of comes back to McDavid, what you guys are doing, which is, you know, I would love to have a chat-like interface that says, I would like to invest in AI tokens. I would like them to actually have some sort of semblance of being able to use for AI servers or anything like that. But most of them are just like, you know, named AI and people buying. So most of them aren't any better than a meme coin or a dog coin.
Well, the main, like the largest market cap, like in the top, I think 50 to 100 on coin market cap, the AI coins that are in there, they're all like legitimate projects. And a lot of them are doing stuff like decentralized compute. Like it's a, you know, a decentralized network for people to like buy compute to train models.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a common, or like a decentralized way to like, you know, rent GPUs, that kind of stuff. And they have like kind of insane, or there's WorldCoin, which is like a proxy. It's like kind of AI adjacent slash a proxy for OpenAI stock price. I think that a lot of these projects that do have even legitimate use cases so far, they're not like ultra competitive most likely to their non-decentralized counterparts.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's probably how a lot of like VCs and like more serious investors look at these tokens like WorldCoin or RNDR. AI in general is kind of funny because, like, at Aperture, we're building, like, you know, a chatbot interface for interacting with DeFi.
Yeah.
And a chatbot interface, I think that's really going to be like a table stakes user experience 5 years from now across decentralized or centralized tech applications. Because when you're, if you've anyone who's ever been on the inside of a company that's building a front end, meaning you have a website that's providing some service, and you have to create buttons and knobs and tools to execute on some kind of back-end code or to, you know, connect to some server or connect to some other application. Like, there's a lot of constraints that front-end places upon the user. And that's because it's very costly to add new knobs and buttons. Like, that takes a long amount of time. And that's a lot of what launching a product means, whether it's in Web 2 or Web 3. And I'm of the belief that just a chatbot is a much more expressive way for a user to get what you want. I mean, we can kind of think of Google. Google is, you know, Google search was in many ways a chatbot before we had that term. Like, you would just type something in, Google kind of like intuitively surface what you want, versus like the Web 1 experience where you had to go through and like search, like manually scroll through some like information page to find what you're looking for. Versus now, everyone kind of starts their, you know, most of their internet journeys on Google. And what we're going to see with this like kind of AI movement, in my opinion, is like a end consumer, you're really going to see that your primary interaction to get something done, not just to get information, but to have something executed, buy a flight, swap for an asset, get exposure to like European real estate market through whatever means necessary. Like these kinds of things will happen with a chatbot interaction where you're going to chat and the computer's going to ask probing questions. It's going to clarify. It's going to repeat back to you what you're telling it and make sure that like it understands you correctly. And then ultimately that will go on to, you know, you'll spend money or you'll like receive something or you'll get a product, et cetera. So that's kind of my hot take on AI. And I think the same thing is going to be true for crypto. Instead of people being constrained by the front ends of most of these crypto platforms and having to sift through transactions, which are impossible even for someone who's native to crypto to fully understand what they're signing on MetaMask. Mm-hmm. A lot of that will be kind of obfuscated by the sort of chatbot that's going to hold your hand, translate things for you, translate your language into blockchain language, et cetera.
I mean, that would solve a few pain points that we've had as like from inception, right? So I would be excited about that. I am excited that a lot of these projects are tackling this idea of decentralized computing, because I think that's been something that I actually get asked about a lot. It's this idea that you're talking about decentralization, but at the end of the day, you are sure incorporating, you know, decentralized transactions and auditability, but then it's all going onto a centralized cloud. It's all going onto centralized repositories. It's being, you know, farmed in like a server farm that's completely centralized. And so I get a lot of these questions in, you know, organizations or governments or companies that are really keen on leveraging these aspects, but then say, okay, but only one layer of this is. And so if we do have a lot of projects that are supporting, you know, greater decentralization across the vertical infrastructure stack, then I'm really excited by that. So I'm kind of happy that these projects are burgeoning. But I completely agree with you. I'd love to see people have more informed consent and be able to interact with the different projects through chatbots, through ways that sort of make sure that they know what they're getting into, that they have information that gives them the opportunity to give informed consent, and that hopefully it alleviates a lot of the concerns around UX for a lot of users around the world. Also interesting around the reach that you could have with a chatbot, because you could, you know, enable multiple languages, you could enable different levels of you know, technological knowledge and availability and infrastructure. And so I think it's particularly exciting to sort of understand the possible effects this might have on this element and realm of inclusion. And that is also exciting to me.
And it's way better than asking Twitter or Reddit.
God, yes. The bar is in hell.
Yes. So let's be clear. I'd much rather, if I'm asking questions about an investment, get answers from the white paper and from regulatory filings, and from, you know, past history, than some, you know, some dude that's, you know, hawking a meme coin on Twitter. So fabulous. Last story to bring it to a wraps, because I listen. Tether, like I said, it's to me, it's amazing that they have not had a black swan event. We thought the last bull run was going to be kind of deprecated by Tether, and it turns out as long as they just keep printing and they keep their smart contracts running, that everything's fine. Except for the EU, does not seem to be okay with them. So they just got delisted from OKX, which is crazy, because OKX literally runs on USDT. Like, that's it. There is no secondary option. So this is only for the EU users at this time. But to me, it's like they did not have USDC. They did not have DAI. They did not have anything else. So I think this is coming, and it's really going to be showing that we're going to be seeing some regulated stablecoins showing up. And without stablecoins, I don't believe the crypto market can be where it is today. So to me, this is kind of a big story.
I think it is true. And I also think it's interesting because it also shows you the strength of like the way that the EU is tackling regulations, right? Because it's telling you that they are to be taken seriously, and that these, you know, regulatory compliance has to be a priority for exchanges that are going to be operating in the region. So I think it's a very, very big, bold statement and validation for the EU as a region in terms of the strength of their regulation and how it's leading exchanges and leading other types of projects within the space to really figure out the ways that they're going to comply, regardless of, you know, what it costs them. Because obviously, you know, now they're going to have to figure out another solution for stablecoin. They have to have one. So they're going to have to figure out another solution. Obviously, this is an incredible market advantage for Circle to come in and say, yeah, let's expand everywhere. And I think, you know, I would be surprised if they weren't already doing that. But I think this is quite compelling from the perspective of understanding the ramifications of regulatory clarity within the EU and how that can then how that is conducive to strategic decision making on behalf of exchanges and projects. And then very curious to see what the impact on users is as OKX sort of looks to solve this problem of having an available stablecoin within their offerings.
Do we know why? Did they officially say what the reasoning was?
Regulatory restrictions, which generally means that somebody needs to be legally liable. Mm-hmm. And Tether is you know, kind of a little bit decentralized. Circle is not. Circle is regulated. You know, there is a Euro stablecoin coming. There's the digital pound that's coming out of the UK. So we're seeing quite a lot of these things come. I mean,
this might also be a play for that, right? If they have this coin coming, then they might want to be guaranteeing adoption on more, you know, regulated centralized channels than having USDT operate.
Stablecoins are big money. I mean, huge money. I mean, Tether's got one of the largest stacks of Bitcoin. They're just like, I don't know. We'll just, you know, they got billions of dollars of profits just from these things existing. So I think it'll be very interesting. We're currently seeing the landscape moving quite a bit. We've run out of time. And so I want to thank Lucia. Thank you so much. We dragged you on here a little bit ahead of time. McDavid, fabulous to meet you, man. Really excited to kind of keep progress of the different projects you guys are working on. I love the concept of natural language trading and settlement. So that's really fabulous. Real quick, if people want to know more about what you're doing, where can they find you?
Hey, yeah, if you want to know more about Aperture, you can find me on Twitter at Rob McStoda, McStoda, or you can find me on Farcaster at McDavid. I was early enough there to get at McDavid.
I got my initials. I'm a three letter on
at JS. So.
Yes.
Good JDS, work.
There we go. Yep. I haven't posted anything, but I'm there. And Lucia, where are you hiding today?
I'm a big fan of LinkedIn. I will never not be a fan of LinkedIn. I'm easy to find there. My inbox is open to receiving messages, so I'll just give that. And it's just my name, so easy to find. I guess I can be found on Twitter/X as well, but probably less responsive there.
It's a lot of chaos over there. Why Wills, thank you so much. Another one in the bag. We'll see you guys next week. Take care.
Why Wills was founded in 2021 by Jay Steinbeck, a passionate entrepreneur and business owner, with the purpose of bringing YPO and YNG members together in the cryptoverse. Why Wills is a collaborative and confidential community centered around cryptocurrencies and blockchain technology, an exclusive crypto hub of more than 600 members. To be notified when we release new content, please subscribe to our show in your preferred listening app. For more information, visit www.ywhales.com. Why Wills is not affiliated with YPO, but at this time only allow for YPO, YPO Gold, and YNG members due to privacy and confidentiality. Support and production for today's episode was done by Truthwork Media. Nothing in the podcast constitutes professional and or financial advice, nor does any information on the podcast constitute a comprehensive or complete statement of the matters discussed or the law relating thereto.